From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
Custer's Ghost by Clark Howard. The old man learned of the anniversary ceremony entirely by accident. One of the previous night's patrons had left a newspaper on the bar, and it was still there when the old man came in early the next morning to clean up. Wiping down the bar, he had picked up the paper to throw it away, but his still quick eyes had caught a glimpse of two words that he recognized beneath a picture on the open page. The picture of an old man like himself meant nothing to him, but the two words beneath it had been etched in his mind for 50 years. Stopping his work, he studied the words carefully. To be certain, he was not mistaken. He could not read, so he studied each letter, all 14 of them. They spelled WENDELLSTEWART. Wendell Stewart. When the old man was absolutely sure that the letters and words were the same as he remembered, he carefully folded the newspaper and put it in the pocket of his old worn coat, which he had hung inside the door. Then he resumed his job of cleaning up the saloon. 3 hours later, when his work was done, the old man locked up the saloon, put on his frayed coat, and limped down the little New Mexico town's main street to a combination cafe pool hall above which he had a room. He went into the kitchen of the cafe and showed the newspaper to Elmo, the black fry cook. "Read this for me, please, Elmo," he said. "I can't read, John," the black man said without embarrassment. "Ask Stella." The old man took the newspaper to Stella, the white waitress, who was filing her nails on a stool behind the cash register. "Will you read this for me, please, Stella?" he asked. "Sure, John. Which one? This one?" "Sure." Stella cleared her throat. "It says, ceremony plan for 50th anniversary of Custer Battle. You want me to read the whole story?" John nodded. "Yes, please." "Sure. A ceremony commemorating the 50th anniversary of the Battle of the Little Bighorn and the defeat and death of General George A. Custer and his 7th Cavalry has been scheduled for June 25, 1926, at the Custer Battlefield National Monument near Hardin, Montana. Being honored at the ceremony will be former Cavalry Corporal Wendell Stewart, one of the survivors of A Company, commanded by Major Marcus Reno, which was also nearly annihilated on a ridge 3 miles away after the Custer Massacre. Stewart, one of 20 men who received the Congressional Medal of Honor for bravery that day, is believed to be the sole survivor of the Custer Regiment. He is 73 years old. Stella paused and studied the old man to whom she was reading. "Say, John, you must be about the same age as him, aren't you?" "I am almost 70 summers," John answered. Stella cracked her chewing gum. "You sure talk funny sometimes, John. Want me to read the rest?" "No, that is enough. Can you tell me what is the number of today?" "You mean the date?" "Sure. This is yesterday's paper, so today must be Thursday, June 16, 1926. "How many days is it until the day the newspaper speaks of?" "Well, let's see, that would be..." Stella counted on her fingers. 9 days, not counting today." She tilted her head, raising one eyebrow curiously. "Why? You're not thinking of going up there, are you, John? It's a mighty long way." "How long away?" Stella shrugged. "I don't know. A long, long way. That's Montana, and this here is New Mexico. I can tell you this. We're at the bottom of the map, and that's at the top. Two customers came in, and Stella went to wait on them. John folded the newspaper and went back into the kitchen. How far is it to Montana? He asked Elmo. The fry cook smiled. Now you're asking the right man, he said proudly. I ain't never learned to read, but brother, I done hoboed all over this here country, top to bottom and side to side. Between here and Montana, you got Colorado and you got Wyoming. I expect you about 1,200 miles. A good long piece, my friend. Thank you, Elmo, the old man said. He went out the kitchen door and limped up the back stairs, favoring his right leg. There were three rooms above the cafe. Elmo lived in one. An old Mexican with a government pension lived in another, and John occupied the third. Because John had dark skin, most people thought he was also Mexican, or at least part Mexican, but he was not. In his little room, John spread the newspaper on top of a faded old bureau in which he kept his few clothes. From the bottom drawer he removed an odd-looking pouch shaped like but slightly larger than a saddlebag, from the bottom of which hung what appeared to be, and in fact was, a brown hairy tail. The pouch itself was also hairy, except in spots where the hair had worn off, leaving a shiny brown skin. It was a buffalo bag, and it was almost as old as John himself. Opening the flap, John pulled out a faded blue cavalry campaign hat, its brim bent and broken, its crown crushed and lifeless. The old man straightened out as best he could and placed it upside down next to the picture in the newspaper. On the inside band of the hat, just barely legible after so many years, were the same 14 letters and two words that he had found in the newspaper. Wendell Stewart. John shifted his eyes to the newspaper and stared at the face above the name. As he did so, he reached down and rubbed the dull, constant pain in his right leg. So he thought, the spirits have finally brought you to me, after 50 years. For many years he had used the name John Walker, but once he had been Walks Across Prairies, a young Oglala warrior and a follower of Crazy Horse, his chief. His people had been members of the 7 tribes which made up the Great Teton Sioux Nation. He had ridden a pony bareback across the vast high grass, the plain that stretched from the foot of the Black Hills all the way to the Rosebud and the place the Bluecoats called Montana. Child, boy, and young man, he had been a Sioux. When the spell of the moment was over, and he no longer stared hypnotically at the photo of Wendell Stewart, the old man reached into his buffalo bag again and drew forth a crudely made but structurally solid and well-crafted stone and pine hatchet. It was his war club of long ago, and the wood of the pine handle was so old it had petrified nearly as solid as the smooth rock that was its head. He closed his still strong right hand around the handle and held the club diagonally across his chest. In the cracked mirror above the bureau, he looked at his old lined face, its skin now similar in texture to the buffalo bag itself. His hair, though still thick, was white like a summer cloud. The line of his mouth had relaxed with the passage of time and no longer served to advise others of the arrogance and defiance that once burned inside him. He knew that much of the fire had gone out of him, but he was pleased to see that his eyes were still clear and alert. The spirits, he thought, always knew what they were doing. His grandfather, Many Leaves, had taught him that when he was a boy living in the teepee of one of his father's wives. If the great spirits did not know in which direction to go, they would not move at all, Many Leaves had told him, and added quietly, unlike human beings. It was obvious to John what the spirits now wanted him to do. The picture and the words in the white man's newspaper had been his sign. He was to return to the great battlefield and meet the bluecoat called Wendell Stewart, the soldier who had wounded his right leg with a long, shiny saber and given him his limp. For 50 years of pain, he was to kill Wendell Stewart. The next morning, when the sun began to rise, John turned his right shoulder toward the light and began walking. His buffalo bag was slung over one shoulder, and he also carried an old carpet bag he had stolen years earlier from a drummer of needles and thread. On his feet he wore his high-top white man's shoes, but in the buffalo bag he carried the last pair of moccasins he had made for himself some 10 years earlier. When he got to the high grass, he would put on the moccasins. He walked down the street to the little New Mexico town where he had made his home for more than 9 years, and without a backward glance or regret, began his journey north. The first day he passed through towns called Hatch, Erie, Caballo, and Churchillo, and by dusk was in a place called Socorro. He did not know addition and subtraction as such, so he had no way of figuring that he had to travel 130 miles in each of the 9 days he had in order to arrive at the battlefield on the day of the ceremony. He knew only that it was north and far away, and since the spirits wanted him to get there in time, he would get there in time. His leg hurt as he walked, as it always did, but it was advantageous in a way because his limp provided him with many rides. Farmers and wagons gave him lifts. Country people driving buggies stopped for him. Salesmen in Model T cars took him from town to town so that they could have someone to talk to. "Yes, sir, I paid $350 for this little buggy," one of them said the second day north of Albuquerque. "Never thought I'd pay that much money for any car, but it's worth it. Got a self-starter. Don't even have to crank it." John merely grunted. The costs meant nothing to him. He seldom had more than a little money. Mostly he earned only enough for food, shelter, and clothing. But that had always been enough. His needs were few and simple. His travel day began at the first hint of sunup. As soon as he was able to tell direction, he was up and moving. During the day, he ate berries and other wild fruit. At night, he stole corn and melons from the fields when he could and picked up a stray chicken here and there. He would have trapped small game for his meals, but he was in too much of a hurry. Nights he slept in haystacks or woods. The second night it rained and he slept under a country bridge. It had been a long time since he had slept outdoors. It was good to see the stars last thing before going to sleep. John was pleasantly surprised that he did not dream during his journey. For 50 years, since the long-ago day of the battle, he had dreamed sporadically of Custer. Long Hair, as he had been called by Crazy Horse. Long Hair often came to him in his dreams. Buckskin clad, yellow hair flowing from under the wide-brimmed white leather hat. In the dreams, Custer would walk directly toward him, eyes fixed, arms swinging slightly, pistols stuck in the belt of his buckskin coat. He would keep coming, growing larger and larger, seeming bent on trotting over John. Finally, he would fill the boundaries of John's mind, become too big for the dream itself, and that was when John would wake up. John was convinced that his dream image was Custer's ghost, and he hated and feared the dream. As the trip back took him closer and closer to the only place where he had ever seen Long Hair, he had presumed he would be troubled by the dream every night, but he was not, and that made him even more sure of the spirits that had planned his journey. Even without the dreams, however, he found himself thinking of Custer as he traveled. The time of the battle was as fresh in John's mind in 1926 as it had been immediately after it happened in 1876. There had been 12,000 in their vast camp on the banks of the Little Bighorn back then. Teepees stretched for 3 miles on both sides of the river. Tatanka Yatanka, the great Unkpapa medicine man, whose name translated to Sitting Buffalo, but whom the Bluecoats called Sitting Bull, had summoned every tribe on the northern plains to come forward and counsel with him about the encroachment of the whites into the land that had been ceded to them by the Fort Laramie Treaty of 1868. All of South Dakota, west of the Missouri River, including the sacred Black Hills and all of the Powder River country of Montana, was supposed to be theirs. It was known as the Great Sioux Reservation and hunting ground. There they had lived in peace with all tribes, except the unworthy Crow, of course, for 8 years. Then someone had found gold in the Black Hills, and the greedy whites had swarmed in like ants to an anthill. The Sioux had lashed out to protect what the white chief had ceded to them. When the soldiers began their marches from faraway places called Omaha and St. Paul, Sitting Bull sent word for all tribes to join him at the Little Bighorn. For the first time ever, they came together as one people. The Unkpapa, Oglala, Minikanju, Sons Ark, Blackfoot, Brule, even the austere, high-minded Northern Cheyenne, who considered themselves the superior ones. For the first time ever, their leaders, Crazy Horse, Low Dog, Gall, Black Moon, Big Road, Two Moon, and Hump, were all disenchanted with a white man at the same time. 12,000 people gathered to hear Sitting Bull's medicine, and of that number, 4,000 were of fighting age. Walks Across Prairies had just turned 19. Since he had been a boy of 11, there had been peace with the white eyes. Walks Across Prairies had never counted a coup, except among the shiftless Crow, and that certainly was no honor to boast about. When he complained to his grandfather Many Leaves about it, Many Leaves had said, "A worthy enemy is a valuable thing, but no enemy at all is even more valuable. Count coup with a buffalo, my grandson, so that an old man like me might have a new robe before the snow comes." Walks Across Prairies had taken his grandfather's advice, and for a while he was content with his lot. But when the call came from Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse ordered the camp struck and moved to the Little Bighorn, the young brave felt a new kind of excitement in his breast, an excitement that meant war paint. On the third day of his journey, John made it into Colorado and was picked up by an oil truck driver going from Alamosa to Mineral Hot Springs. "Know anything about this feller Tunney that got matched with a champ?" the man asked. John shook his head. He did not know what the man was talking about. "I seen a picture of him," the trucker said. "Looks pretty fancy to me. Ain't even got much of a beard. You know, that Dempsey, why, he's got such a rough beard he can draw blood with it." "This Dempsey, is he a warrior?" John asked. "I'll say," the truck driver laughed. It did not bother John that even after 50 years he knew so little about the ways of the white man's world. He had not tried to learn more than he knew. He felt it was enough that he could now speak the language. Until he was 25 he spoke only Sioux, because after the great battle he had followed Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull into exile in Canada. The great chiefs knew that the white government would not tolerate the great victory over the Bluecoats. "When the white eyes defeat us, it is a victorious campaign," Many Leaves had said. "But when we defeat them, it is a massacre." The white eyes are clever with words. Following the battle, great trails of tribes had moved north into Saskatchewan. The chiefs knew that the Bluecoats could not follow them there. Some treaties they would not break. They planned to live on the Canadian side and return secretly to the Montana plain to hunt buffalo, which was not plentiful in Canada. But the Bluecoats, ever spiteful over the massacre, put up intense patrols all along the border, in effect sealing it. They themselves killed buffalo for sport, but would not permit the Indian to kill it for food and hides. Walks Across Prairies remained in Canada for 6 years. For nearly all of the first year he was practically helpless from his severely wounded right leg. The woman cared for him until he could walk again. The first time he realized that he would limp the rest of his life, he cried. Then he imagined what Many Leaves, by then dead, would have said. Something like, "A man is not judged by how straight his legs are, but by how straight his heart is." That was the first of many times to come, when to bolster his spirit, he would imagine something his grandfather probably would have said. A year later, the Custer battle, he saw Crazy Horse lead 1,000 of his people down to Fort Robinson, Nebraska, and take them on to the reservation because he could not feed them. Others began to straggle after him. Gall with his people, then Two Moon, then Low Dog. Finally, after 5 long years, Sitting Bull led the last 43 tattered, starving families down to Fort Buford, Montana, and surrendered. Walks Across Prairies remained in Canada another year, living alone, hunting small game to survive, fishing, occasionally making his way north to Moose Jaw to steal necessities such as rifle cartridges and salt to cure meat. When the loneliness began to gnaw at him, he left Saskatchewan and walked into Manitoba. He walked all the way across that province and entered the United States again at Pine Creek, Minnesota. For 10 long but uneventful years, he wandered mid-America. He crossed to Wisconsin, went over the top of Michigan, down into Indiana, over to Ohio, so far away from the high grass that at times he thought he was in another world. Gradually he adopted the white man's dress and began to do white man's work. He toiled in the fields for white farmers, fished off boats on Lake Huron for white fishermen, cut trees in white timber camps, herded milch cows for white dairymen. He was surprised to find that as time went by, the white eyes regarded him with less and less animosity, and even more surprised to realize that he was beginning to feel the same about them. At all times, for years, he kept his war club handy, but he never had to hit anyone with it. It was a strange life he led, but he slowly became used to it. Traveling now on his journey back to the Little Bighorn reminded John of his incredible lifelong pilgrimage around the United States. The little town in New Mexico, where he had lived for 9 years, was the longest he had ever stayed in one place since his wandering began. At 35, he had been in the Midwest, at 40 and 45 in the Deep South, where he learned to pick cotton. At 50, he had been shoveling coal in the engine room of a New Orleans paddle boat up and down the Mississippi. At 55, he had been a cook's helper on a cattle drive in Texas. At 60, he worked in the oil fields in Oklahoma, where his employer was a Cherokee millionaire. A couple of years later, he had wandered down into the desert of New Mexico because his bones had begun to ache when it rained or snowed, and he remembered many leaves once saying, "After a man passes his 60th summer, he should look for a warm place to die so that he will not feel the chill of death so strongly." John found his warm place in a little desert community where he got the job cleaning up the saloon in the morning and the cafe pool hall at night, for just enough money for food, clothing, and shelter, all a man needed. When the oil truck driver let him out in Mineral Hot Springs, John waved and said, "I hope your warrior, Dempsey, wins the battle." The driver laughed and drove away. That night, John found the bubbling hot spring outside town and soaked his tired old body in it for 3 hours. It made him feel strong again. The spirits still knew what they were doing. On the fourth day, he passed through Poncha Springs, Colorado, walking Buena Vista, riding a hay wagon, Leadville on an ore truck, Dowd walking. Day 5 took him out of Colorado and into Wyoming. He passed the welcome sign at the state line. He couldn't read it, but he knew he was making progress because for the first time in many years he saw purple prairie clover growing in the edge of fields. He collected some and put into his buffalo bag to dry. He also found some wild currant flowers that day and picked 50 of their small blue-black berries. That night, near Saratoga, he trapped a young rabbit, roasted and ate its legs, and stretched the rest of the meat out, crushed the berries all over it, poured fat from the cooked meat of the rabbit on top of that, and pounded all of it together with a rock. Then he laid it out to dry by his campfire. By morning, it would be pemmican, a dry, emergency food much like beef jerky he could carry with him the rest of the trip. Afterward, he steeped the purple prairie clover in water he boiled in a tin cup, and made himself some wonderful tea to warm his old bones against the night air. On the sixth day, he made it to within 20 miles of Casper, and the next morning was given a ride on a Baptist revival bus all the way to Sheridan, more than 150 miles. With half of the day still left, he walked out of Sheridan, and by late afternoon came suddenly upon the Tongue River and knew he was in the high grass country again, Montana. He made his bed that night on the bank of the Tongue, and for the first time in many years he dreamed not just of Custer, but of Custer's death. "Today is a good day to fight and a good day to die," Chief Low Dog told his warriors, who sat on the ground gathered around him the morning of the battle. Walks across prairie stood nearby with Crazy Horse and other Ogallalas. "Low Dog is a fool," Crazy Horse said quietly to his group. "No day is a good day to die, but every day is a good day to fight and live. I think Low Dog has given his brain to the white man's picture box." The Sioux war chief was highly contemptuous of all the Sioux leaders who, for a few worthless trinkets, had allowed themselves to be photographed during the years of the peace. Crazy Horse himself had never permitted a picture to be taken of him. "I want no one to see my face if I cannot see theirs," he gave as his reason. It was noon that day when Sioux scouts brought them word that Custer's regiment was crossing the plain. "Longhair has split his bluecoats into three forks," the leader of the scouts reported. "The captain called Ben Tween has taken 125 men and turned toward the foothills of the Wolf Mountains. They are moving well away from Longhair. The other captain called Reno has taken 140 men and crossed Rosebud Creek. He now moves in the same direction as Longhair, who has 215 men on the other side of the creek." "How soon will they reach the Little Bighorn River?" Crazy Horse asked. "When the sun is there," the scout replied, pointing to mid-sky in the west, "by 3 o'clock. Gall, who was obnoxious and a braggart, spat on the ground. "Longhair's a fool," he announced. "He will ride right into our midst." Crazy Horse, tall and regal, with a single white feather in his hair, grunted quietly. "Longhair is no fool. A better bluecoat does not live. But his judgment fails him when he chooses scouts. He relies on information given him by the idle-minded, no-account Crow. They are too lazy to scout more than 3 miles ahead of the bluecoats." He smiled. "We will lie in wait 4 miles ahead. We will lure Reno and his soldiers away when they reach the fork of the creek. Then we will meet Longhair at the Little Bighorn." And that was the way it happened. A party of 40 warriors rode up on Reno's column 4 miles from the Little Bighorn. Custer ordered Reno to pursue them with full strength. Reno led his 140 men galloping after the 40 warriors. The warriors led them 3 miles across the plain, where 1,000 more warriors waited for them behind a knoll. Reno and his men were immediately cut off and driven up into a bluff where they took cover and dug in. Custer was now alone with 215 men riding along one side of the creek that ran into Little Bighorn. Crazy Horse, at the head of the other army of 1,000 warriors, waited in a low valley on the other side of the river. When the cavalry column was where Crazy Horse wanted it, the Oglala and his warriors rode up the grassy bank and across a shallow river. Custer and his men were totally, completely, and fatally surprised. No white man or Indian ever fought as bravely as Custer and his men, Ogallala Chief Low Dog would say in an interview at the Standing Rock Agency 5 years later, after he had returned from Canada and surrendered. "The white soldiers stood their ground bravely, and none of them made any attempt to get away. Our warriors were told not to mutilate the head white chief, for he was a brave warrior and died a brave man, and his remains should be respected." When all but 50 of his men lay dead around him, Custer ordered his remaining soldiers to follow him to a small hill that formed the highest point on the immediate plain. There the legendary last stand took place. Crazy Horse's Sioux abandoned their ponies at this point and fought on foot with rifles and war clubs, swarming up the low hill on all sides. Walks Across Prairies had counted 6 coups on his way up the hill. His bare chest and arms were drenched in his enemy's blood. He saw a white man in civilian clothes take a blow to the back of the head from a war club and fall dead. He didn't know until later that it was Custer's brother, Boston Custer, who had been traveling with the 7th Cavalry as a civilian historian. A few minutes later, when there were just a few bluecoats left, perhaps a dozen, he saw a very brave captain standing shoulder to shoulder with Longhair, both of them firing pistols with both hands, until finally a rifle bullet struck him in the throat and he died. That brave captain had been Tom Custer, another brother of Longhair. Many historians were to speculate over the decades that followed whether Custer was the last to die that afternoon. Most conclusions were that it was highly unlikely. But unlikely or not, walks across prairies knew it to be true. Custer lasted the longest that day because his men, who idolized him, fought closely around him and took the early bullets and blows meant for him. Walks across prairies had been 30 feet from Longhair when he took the fatal bullets that killed him. It would have been good, he thought, later, if Crazy Horse could have been the one to kill him. A chief deserved to die at the hand of another chief. But that was not the way that day. Walks across prairies vividly remembered that Longhair was killed by 2 warriors. Mud between the toes shot him in the right breast, and 2 dogs shot him in the left temple. After Custer fell, Crazy Horse stood by the body and said, "Longhair's body is sacred. It shall not be cut." And it had not been. On the last day of his journey, John awoke on a low bluff near a tiny village called Lodge Grass. There was a waterhole directly below the bluff, and it was for that reason that John had chosen to sleep there. He knew that in the early morning the buffalo would come to water and he could watch them. He awoke when he heard the bulls snorting at each other and splashing as the calves ran playfully into the water. John sat up and for an hour watched the big, thick, somehow majestic animals as they started their day. There were about 30 of them, including the young. Just enough, John remembered, to make a good teepee for winter. It took about 20 dressed hides to make a 15-foot teepee, another 10 for ground covering and sleeping robes. Watching them, the old Indian nodded fondly. Then his eyes became sad. Once he thought there would have been 100 or more in the herd that watered there. Now there were 30. He sighed a deep, quiet sigh. The buffalo and the Sioux, he thought, have gone the same way. Soon both would be only memories. When the sun was midway in the morning sky, John prepared for the day. Now that he knew where he was, he knew also how long it would take him to get where he was going. He had about 3 hours' easy walk across the high grass. From his buffalo bag he removed his moccasins and put them on, then packed the rest of his belongings. Before he left the bluff, he searched for and found a cluster of white Dakota snowberries and nearby some thriving bloodroot plants. Securing a quantity of each, he put them on separate flat rocks and squeezed the juices from their flowers and roots. When he was finished, he had 2 small portions of dye, 1 red and 1 white. He wished he could mark his face, but he knew that a painted Indian, even an old one, would have little of any chance of getting past the modern-day bluecoats who guarded the battlefield. So he removed his shirt and streaked only his chest, 1 horizontal white line across the top, as he would have done on his forehead, and 3 vertical lines drawn down from that, which would have covered his nose and each cheek. It was the Sioux symbol of life, the white line being the tribe, the 3 red lines being the stages of life. Child, warrior, old person. For the first time ever, John thought of himself as an old person. If life had gone on as it should have, if the whites had stayed off their land and left them alone, today he would be considered a respected elder and would be treated with honor and dignity, instead of having to clean out a saloon every morning. But soon, he thought, taking the war club from his bag, he would make a place for himself in the last tales to be told around Sioux campfires. He would count 1 more coup and drive the ghost of Custer from his head. As he walked toward the half-century-old battlefield that day, John Walker, walks across prairies, thought about the man he would kill. He knew almost nothing about Wendell Stewart. They had met for only a brief, fleeting instant an hour after the last stand. Walks Across Prairies and some of the other younger Igorgalas had joined Lodog in his assault against Major Marcus Reno and the soldiers who had been lured away from Custer. By that time, Captain Frederick Benteen and the contingent Custer had sent toward the Wolf Mountains had hurried back to reinforce Reno. The young Olalas had fought Custer, were still fresh. It had taken them only 45 minutes to win that battle. By then it was only 4 o'clock on that June afternoon. Still, plenty of daylight left for fighting. It was while Walks Across Prairies was helping fight Reno and Benteen that a young, blonde-haired corporal had seized the saber of a fallen officer and slashed the right calf of Walks Across Prairies as he had ridden through in a pony charge. Walks Across Prairies had swung at the soldier with his war club, felt it glance off bone, and whipped his pony away with the soldier's hat caught on his war club. They had never seen each other again. Now, after 50 years, their fight would resume. By noon, John stood at the edge of the old battlefield where the anniversary ceremony was to take place. There were already a number of people there. They had come in Model T cars, wagons, buggies. John looked around, but he didn't see anyone who resembled the newspaper picture of Wendell Stewart. He waited patiently. Under his shirt, the war paint was dry and hard on his chest, and his buffalo bag was the war club. As he waited, the old man studied the battlefield. There were small marble stones marking where each cavalryman's body had been found. The stones formed a weaving line that snaked its way up the hill. At the top of the hill was a large monument. John walked up and stood beside a schoolboy who was looking at it. "Is this the grave of Custer?" he asked the boy. The boy shook his head. "General Custer is not buried here. They took him back to West Point to bury." John shook his head briefly. That was a sad thing. Longhair would have wanted to sleep with his soldiers. John had never heard of this West Point. He hoped it was a place of honor. "Who lies here?" he asked the boy, touching the monument. "The last 50 men who died with Custer," the boy said. He pointed to a cluster of markers on one side of the hill. "Those are where the last 50 died. The one at the top there is General Custer's. Just behind his is his brother's, Captain Tom Custer. Right next to that is Captain Miles Keogh. His horse Comanche was the only survivor, man or animal, in this whole battle. Except for Indians, of course. And see that marker way down at the bottom? That was General Custer's other brother, Boston Custer." The boy squinted up at the old Indian. "Anything else you want to know?" John shook his head. "No. Thank you for helping me." When the boy left, John walked over to the crest of the hill to Custer's marker. He could still see him, white buckskin field uniform, wide-brimmed white leather hat, flowing yellow silk scarf, saber on his belt, pistol in each hand, firing down into the wall suit coming up the hill, missing Bud between the toes and two dogs, who raised their rifles simultaneously. "Ladies and gentlemen," a voice said through a megaphone at the bottom of the hill, "our anniversary ceremony will begin shortly. Will everyone please gather in front of the museum building?" John watched the visitors move in small groups over to the brick building on the edge of the battlefield. His eyes searched the crowd, but still did not see Wendell Stewart. Frowning, he made his way back down the rise and walked around the edge of the group, studying faces but recognizing none. Finally, he had gone all the way around the crowd and found himself at a side door of the small museum building. There was a young soldier there with a rifle. "May I help you, sir?" he asked. John's frown deepened. "Sir" was the title of respect the bluecoats used when addressing their chiefs. Why would this young soldier use it when speaking to him? Perhaps his old ears had played a trick on him. "I am looking for the old soldier called Wendell Stewart," John said. "The guest of honor," said the soldier. "He's still inside. Use the front door right around there." John nodded. "Thank you." "You're welcome, sir." There, he has said it again. This time John was certain of it. The soldier had called him sir. He had spoken to him with respect. Still frowning, John went around to the front of the museum and entered. There were a few stragglers still inside, looking at maps and photographs and displays of uniforms and other memorabilia from the great battle. John's eyes swept the faces and suddenly stopped, locking on the face of Wendell Stewart. The old white soldier was sitting down. A man, woman, and young girl were standing around him, their backs to John. Although it might have been the imagination, John was almost certain that the instant he recognized Stewart, he felt a sharp surge of pain where the saber had cut the tendons of his right calf. 50 years, and the spirits had brought them together again for the final battle. John's hand went into the buffalo bag and slipped the war club out. He held it at his side, handle gripped tightly. As he eased toward the small cluster of people, he made up his mind to hit Stewart at the top of the head rather than in the face. A soldier who had lived as long as Stewart did not deserve to have his face destroyed. "I will leave him his dignity and take only his life," John decided. Slowly he edged nearer to the man, woman, and young girl, catching only glimpses of the seated Stewart when the people around them shifted their positions. John moved past the back of the man, then the woman, then stepped easily around the young girl to face his old enemy. And there he stopped. Wendell Stewart was in a wheelchair. He had no right leg. Inside John's head, he heard what he imagined many leaves would have said. "It is better to have a leg that hurts for 50 years than to have no leg at all." Wendell Stewart and the three people standing with him all stopped talking and stared at John. Stewart's eyes flicked down to the war club he held. The old white soldier tensed. Softening, John stepped forward and held the club out to the man in the wheelchair. "I hit you in the head with this a long time ago," he said simply. Stewart stared harder at him, frowned, then parted his lips incredulously. "And I cut your leg with Lieutenant Gibson's saber." John nodded. "It has hurt for 50 years. He pulled the old campaign hat out of his bag. "This is yours." Stewart looked at the hat and ran his fingers over it. Tears came to his eyes. The young girl knelt and gave him a handkerchief. "Here, Granddad." "Where did you lose your leg?" John asked. "On that same bluff with Reno and Benteen," the old soldier replied, wiping his eyes. "About an hour after you and I met, I was a little dizzy from the blow on the head you gave me. I didn't get out of the way fast enough, and a Sioux warrior ran a lance through my thigh. By the time we got back to Fort Lincoln 2 days later, I had gangrene, and the post surgeon had to take it off." "I am sorry you lost it," John said. Stewart nodded. "I'm sorry, too, that your leg has hurt for so long." They were next to a wide window that looked out on the markers, the hill, and the great plain beyond. "There was room enough for everyone, red and white," John said. "Yes, yes, there was." The young girl touched John's arm. "What's your name, sir?" "Sir." Again, John almost smiled, but checked it in time. He must maintain his dignity among these strangers, and smiling was not dignified at his age. "I am Walks Across Prairies," he said proudly, "of the Oglala." "Would you like to push my grandfather outside for the ceremony?" she asked. "It would be a great honor." As the old Sioux pushed the old cavalryman to the gathering outside, he asked quietly, "Do you ever dream about Custer's ghost?" "No," Stewart said. "I dream about Crazy Horse's ghost." Walks Across Prairies nodded solemnly. The spirits did know what they were doing.